This is a workshop speaker meeting on the topic of the ultimate weapon. And I would like to introduce our first speaker, Carla.
Carla!
I'm an addict named Carla. And I need to take a moment of silence for me to be able to breathe. I played pickleball this afternoon, and walking up those steps took my breath away. So I'm like, oh my God, how did I play pickleball? Now I walk up the steps and I'm like, maybe because I'm nervous. No matter how often I do this, it just doesn't get easier. When I first got clean, like, my goal was not to become a public speaker ever. However, as far as the ultimate weapon goes, I can only keep what I have by giving it away. And so here I am. I was asked to be of service. Thank the committee for asking me to speak on the ultimate weapon. And I'm a reader. I like to read. I also like social media. I like to Google. So I Googled Ultimate Weapon Narcotics Anonymous just to see what would come up. So I knew it was in our basic text, and part of why I did that is because I didn't know where it was in the basic text. So it came right up. This is the fifth edition, but it's still on the same page, on page 15 and 16. And I just wanted to read it because it's the topic of the meeting, is the ultimate weapon. And I like to go to the literature, because what I was told early on is that the literature is the program, and that the people are the fellowship, and that the fellowship may let you down, but the literature won't. So what the literature says about the ultimate weapon, it says the ultimate weapon for recovery is the recovering addict. We concentrate on recovery and feelings, not what we have done in the past. Old friends, places, and ideas are often a threat to our recovery. We need to change our playmates, playgrounds, and playthings. And when I was thinking about what I was going to share, I went back to my early recovery when I first came around. This isn't a promotion of treatment, but it's part of my story. I went to treatment at an intervention of my son. He was 17 at the time, and I was out there ripping and running. I was coming to the end where I was living to use, using to live, and I just didn't want to live that way anymore, but I didn't know what to do. And I went home one night. I had this intervention from my son, so I chose to go to treatment because the ultimatum he gave me was, I'm going to go live with Granny, which was my mother, if you don't get it together. And his father had died when he was 8. And it still sticks with me to this day. He's like, my father's dead. You're the only parent I have. I can't lose you too. And it still gets me emotional when I think about that. So that's what I chose to do. And, you know, I was in treatment for a whole 8 days because my insurance wouldn't cover anymore. And my counselor told me, he's like, you know, in 5 days, he's like, we're going to get you some more. I don't know how much more we can get you, but you need to be here for a while. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, what? What is he talking about? So they got me 3 more days. So I went there. I was in treatment for 8 days. But when I was there, like, I heard something. And, you know, what I heard was, when you get out, go to meetings, get a sponsor, get a home group. They took us to some outside meetings. And when they brought those meetings in there, you know, I saw what I wanted. It was attractive to me. Like, people were happy and they were smiling. And when I was using, I would just go to something so simple as to the grocery store and look around and be like, how do I get to be like those people? You know, how do I get to be like them? Why do they look so happy? And inside, I'm dying. And, you know, when I saw that in Narcotics Anonymous, I was like, that's what I want. That's how I want to live. And I didn't know how to get it. And that's when I was thinking, like, that ultimate weapon. You know, if it wasn't for the people I met in early recovery, I probably would not even be standing here. And so when I got out of treatment, I went and stayed with my mom and stepfather, because I didn't want to go back home to the toxic, abusive relationship with the ex-husband who was still using, because he didn't want to get clean because he didn't need this. Meantime, he's the one that got put out of the crack house, not me. And I'm like, are you sure you don't need this? So I went to live with my mom in Eldersburg for probably about 5 months. And when I was there, I started going to meetings. I did what was suggested. when I left. And I will say, you know, I work in this field. Everything's still the same. I did this in 2000, so it's like 25 years ago. The things are still the same. They're still the same suggestions. Get a network, get a home group, get a sponsor, work the steps, pray, go to meetings, and don't pick up. It's still the same thing. So, you know, with that being said, that's what I did. And then, like 5 months later, I had to move back home because my son was still there with my ex-husband, who was not his father. And, you know, it just wasn't a good environment for him. He was begging me to come back. And I was really worried about my recovery because in the 5 months I had lived with my mom, I had, like, built a network. I had a sponsor. I had a home group. I had a service commitment. I had all these things. So when I went back home, I went right back into that toxic environment. And I would love to say I stayed clean, but I didn't. You know, I wound up having a bunch of feelings that I didn't know what to do with. And I wound up picking back up. And I stayed out for like 3 more months. And then I've decided, like, I'm done. I don't want to live this way. I had enough taste of recovery that I knew there was a better way to live. So, you know, I told my ex-husband, I was like, look, I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. Of course, it didn't help that I'd stolen his truck and had went out to get drugs. And he was calling me, I can't remember what the name of that thing is, but it had some kind of program on where you could find out where you were and send the police. And I'm like, yeah, I think I'm probably done here. Because I have, when I relapsed, I went right back to the same stuff I was doing, right? Ways and means to get more, using to living to use. So with that, and it's going to bug me, whatever that thing was, LoJack, that's it, LoJack. It was a while ago, like I said, I went to treatment in 2000. So I brought the truck back home, and I was just like, I'm done. So I went to a meeting that night, I got my key tag, and I stayed clean for 2.5 years until I picked back up. But I want to touch on that 2.5 years that I stayed clean because I'm here, so obviously I got clean again. But when I moved back home, because I lived in Perry Hall, so I went back there, and I started going to meetings. I got a home group, got a network, got a sponsor, got involved in service. I joined special events, which was fabulous because I'm generally an introvert. Like, I like my cats better than people. Doesn't mean that I don't interact with people and all that other kind of stuff because I know better now. But, you know, I'm still an introvert. I can isolate real easy. And so I started making friends and started building this network. And, you know, what happened was, because when I came in here, I didn't come in here with any friends. You know where I lie? I had one. I had one friend. And she wasn't one of us. And actually, she's still my friend to this day. God love her. She's the kind of friend that when we go out to lunch, she'll say, does it bother you if I have a beer? And I'm like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't at all. Today it doesn't. It used to before, and she wouldn't drink around me, but now I don't care. So I started getting friends. And I remember that we were out one night, and my friend looked at me, and she said, Carla, if you don't stop cutting me off when you talk, I can't be friends with you anymore. And I had no idea what she was talking about. I'm like, what? And, you know, she told me, but it was in a kind and loving way, where it kind of, like, made me cringe. Like, oh, my God, I do that? But in the same token, I was so grateful to her because I really did that. Like, if we were having a conversation, you know, halfway when you're talking, I'm like, and so I learned not to do that. I will say this. It was not a good suggestion for me to tell my mother when she did it to me to not do it. However, it was funny because it worked the same way with my mother. Like later, you know, later on, she's like, oh, my God, do I do that? And I was like, yeah. And then I told her how it came to be that I know I did that. And so, again, the ultimate weapon, it helped my mother and I have a better relationship because we were more aware of what we were doing, we were talking, and what that does, it allows you to do more listening to the other person. Because I'm thinking about what I'm going to say, and I'm not listening the word to you, and, you know, I'm just poop. The other thing that happened, there was another friend, there was a group of us, and she asked me to go to a concert with her. And I'm like, wow, like nobody ever asked me to do those things. And it was just, I will say, it was just a little neighborhood local church concert, but we went and sat out in the field, listened to music, and I mean, I had the best time ever. I was like, wow, this is what it's like to have a friend. And, you know, this is what it's like to have somebody teach me how to live, how to be a woman, how to be a friend, how to be a mother, just how to be a human being, right? Because I love that that part of the literature talks about failed to function as a human being, right? Because I'm like, that was me. That was me, just complete and total, that one sentence. And so I learned, right? I learned from the people that came before me that taught me how to act. Also in my home group, and again, this is 25 years ago, I don't think we still do it because NA's become softer and gentler and nicer, but in my home group, they told me to sit down, shut the F up, and if they want to hear from me, they'll ask me how to use, because that's all I know how to do. And I'm like, damn. I was offended, right? Because I'm thinking, I have all this knowledge, you guys just don't know. So I was like, wow. And then they followed it up with, you cannot speak in this meeting for your first 30 days, and we don't want to hear from you. If you want what we have, you will come early, talk to people then, sit quiet for the meeting, and if you want to talk to us, you'll talk after the meeting. I'm like, damn. Like, I was like, I didn't know NA had guidelines. But you know what? That was what I did. And that ultimate weapon of that home group and those early friends are the reason why I'm still here, because I needed to do that. I needed to listen. I needed to hear the message, because all I had was a mess, right? And, you know, I couldn't wait till 30 days. You know, I've raised my hand. I'm like, my 30 days are up. I can talk now. And, you know, and I shared at that meeting, but it also taught me to get to the meeting early, like how to build relationships, how to build friendships. If that ultimate weapon is another recovering addict, then I needed to know how to do that, because I didn't. Left to my own devices, I would just come sit in a chair and not say a word. I would be happy. When I was in middle school, I was that girl that liked to stand against the wall, like the wallflower, and just like, please nobody come talk to me, because I'm really uncomfortable, it's really awkward, and I just prefer not. So, you know, I needed that. They knew what I needed when I didn't even know what I needed. And then I joined special events and, you know, showed up for the dipping dances. I don't even think they have them anymore. I'm not sure. Because it was in Northeast Freedom. It was in this area. So I would show up for the dipping dances. And we had, what else did we have? Rocking bowls and skating. Just all those things. And again, getting me outside of myself, the dances. You know, because I love to dance. I didn't know how to do it clean, but I learned just by going. And, you know, like, I was just reflecting on this topic. Without those people in early recovery, you know, who knows? That was my example. My sponsor telling me to get numbers of women at meetings. Like, my home group does this thing, sorry, Howard, where they have... We have these phone books and ask people if they want any numbers of people in recovery at the meeting. And it just irks me, because I'm like, when I first got clean, I had to walk up to people with this phone book and be like, can I have your phone number? I mean, today you can do it with these things, but it's like, I wouldn't know whose face went with what number if I didn't ask you for it. And, you know, my sponsor had me go up to 3 women at every meeting I went to and get their number, and I had to call them, and then I had to report back to her, like, who did I call? What meeting did you go to? Whose numbers did you get? And, like, she actually asked me these questions. So I knew I had to do it, because I didn't want to disappoint her, right? Because she was my sponsor for a reason. I wanted what she had, and if she would have told me to go stand in the corner and spit out wooden nickels for 5 minutes, I just would have went and did it, because she knew how to stay clean, because she had more time than me and had work steps, and I wanted what she had. It was really attractive. So, you know, with that being said, those are the kind of things I had to do in my early recovery. And the home group, you know, it was vital. That home group was really vital. So when they say get a home group, seriously, get a home group. Get one you like that you can show up. Because that ultimate weapon isn't just the recovering addicts you see at the meeting. It's the recovering addicts in your home group. It's your sponsor. It's the relationship you have with your higher power. It's working the steps, what you do with another recovering addict, ideally your sponsor. And then also in my home group, what it taught me was I had gotten enough time, and they volunteered me to be the GSR, and I had no idea what that meant, right? I don't know what the GSR is, but they volunteered me for it, so I was like, okay, I don't know. I'd heard it called Area Circus, and I had heard things about it, so I was a little on the fence, but I was like, okay, well, they want me to do it. So the GSR at my home group was like, look, I will meet you there. I'll walk you through it. I'll show you everything to do. And he did. He showed up, and he did that for me for, like, maybe two more times. And then when I was comfortable enough to go on my own, off I went. And then when I was, leading the GSR, our group conscience meeting, right, he was sitting up there beside me. And, I mean, I needed all that. I needed people to hold my hand and say, hey, this is how you do it. Let's show, I'll show you how it works. And, I will say we talk about the ultimate weapon, too, I'm going to add this in there because when I came around, I was still married, but my husband and I were separated. And I went to a couple meetings, and, like, I knew how to talk to the guys. I was talking to the women, and we were developing friendships, but I could do better with the guys because it was easier to control and manipulate. It just was, I'll be honest. And I remember being at a couple meetings and my sponsor coming over to me going, why are you over there with them? Come sit with me. So I go sit with her. Then I go back out in the parking lot and there's more guys and I'm over there talking to them and here she comes. Carla, what are you doing over here? Why are you talking to the guys? And I'm like, because they're easier to talk to. And she's like, no, they're not. It's like, you need to stick with the women. So it's like, okay. So it's just like these little things that, that I've learned. And thank God when I came around, people had patience with me. Because, like, I used for 24 years, I really didn't have a lot of coping skills. And I had no idea what to do with feelings. So, if I was feeling some type of way, like when my friend told me that, I cut people off and she can't be friends with me unless I stop. Like, I didn't know what to do with all those feelings. It's like I knew I wanted to not do that anymore because I wanted to please her. I wanted her in my life. I liked her. She was my friend. And I forgot where I was going with that. So I really forgot where I was going with that. Feelings. So when those feelings came up, like, I didn't know what to do with them. And I'd come into meetings, and I'd want to throat punch people that would be like, feelings aren't facts, but facts are, or no, feelings, fact, feelings aren't facts, but it's a fact you're feeling them. And I'm like, what do I do with that? And I would hear all those cliches, and they would really make me angry because I didn't understand them. And I went to this meeting one time, and this girl with a lot of clean time did her whole meeting on the cliches and broke them down and what they meant. And after that, I was like, oh my God, I love them. So it's, again, what I'm giving you an example of how we help each other in this process, because we're each other's eyes and ears. Because when I was out there using, excuse me, there was no ultimate weapon when I was using, it was just me and my addiction. Right, I had nothing to back it up, nobody to help me. If I wanted something, I had to figure it out myself. And generally, it was just like, who can I steal from? How can I cover it up? What can I do? And like I said, I came in with like no relationships. My relationships were very skewered, and I didn't really know how to be in a relationship with a guy either. I'll just be honest. I just wasn't really good with relationships, period. It didn't matter who or what you were. And thank God, I'm just going to fast forward it, when I met my husband, because again, I got divorced from my ex-husband. Maybe I'll touch on that. And when I did get divorced from him is when I relapsed. I had 2.5 years clean. I'd been working steps, I'd been doing all these things. But what happened was, when I was working steps and doing all these things, my ego got like this. Because all of a sudden, it's like, I'm recovering. Don't you know who I am? Right? I have 2.5 years clean. I'm on step 6, and this is my sponsor. And when I got divorced, I had some health problems. And the suggestions that were given to me I kind of took him, but not really. I didn't really listen to him. And the person that I was dating at the time had a little more clean time than my sponsor. And I'm dating him, and he's the guy. And I'm like, I'm going to take his suggestions. Screw her. Needless to say, it didn't end well. I wound up cashing in my clean time. And, you know, but what that did was it strengthened my program. It made me really take a hard look at myself. And I remember when I went to get my white key tag, you know, it's like that walk of shame. And after I was done and I got it, some of the women came up to me and hugged me. And it's like, God, we're so glad you finally went and got that key tag. And I'm like, how did you know? You know, and they're like, you're yellow. How could we not know? You know, we know when somebody's using. And, you know, they helped love me back. Right. Because I can tell you what, coming off that relapse, I was talking to my husband. I'm not going to give his topic away, but I was saying that's the only thing I can think of on that topic that you've got, because, like, it took me till I celebrated my third year to forgive myself. That's a really long time to not forgive yourself, but that's just my process, because I was so happy and so proud and loved the way I lived for those 2.5 years, you know. And I will say this, I remember, you know, when I had that choice in my mind, I was either going to go get my key tag or I was going to go back out, because I had some money saved, right? Because that's what happens when we get clean, right? We get an instant raise. I'd had some money saved. And I remember sitting at the ATM, like, just with my card in my hand, and I'm like, I'm not doing it. And I just drove away. And later that evening, my husband and I, we weren't married yet, but we were living together. And I asked him, you know, what we had left as far as pill-wise. Fortunately, it was something that I was highly allergic to. And I was like, well, I can't take that. So let's get a key tag. And, you know, that's what we did. And that's, you know, also like the ultimate weapon. You know, I'm just going to touch on my marriage because I only have a few minutes left. It's like my husband and I are in recovery, you know, both of us. And, you know, how we keep our relationship together is like he works his program because he has his own ultimate weapons and I have my own ultimate weapon. You know, but the bottom line is we're also each other's ultimate weapon, right? Because we just went on a cruise and, you know, the drinking bothered me to a point and I didn't even realize it. And he looked at me, he's like, what's wrong with you? You know, and I'm thinking, I don't know. You know, I'm not really sure. And it wasn't until I went to a meeting and I heard somebody share that the light bulb went off in my head. I was like, oh, that was it. You know, and we talked about it and I feel a lot better. And what that did was the next time I go somewhere like that, I'm going to have a better plan than thinking I can just outrun my disease. Right? Because I'm an addict. My disease goes with me everywhere I go. I outran it that day, but that doesn't mean I'm going to do it tomorrow. So anyway, the ultimate weapon was a great topic. I'd just like to thank Nathan for asking me at this convention. And that's all I've got. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Carla. Our next speaker is Mike.
I'm an addict. My name is Mike.
Hi, Mike.
And look, people are leaving. I love it. Now, I was telling Carly, I think about 12 years ago, we shared at this convention a workshop together. And here it is today. We're standing here together. And we weren't the original speakers, so you guys got the backups. But I'm grateful for Nathan and this convention being here. You know, I love this convention. You know, I was thinking, a friend of mine just celebrated 15 years, and I brought him this convention, his first convention, and we were back at the old place with that atrium that everybody was talking about. We're breaking in and empty. Everybody's watching people in, blah, blah, blah. And we were in there, we were chanting, and people were getting their one-day key tags, and, you know, and we're sitting there, and he'd been clean like 3 or 4 months. And we're sitting there, and everybody's banging, keep coming back. And you could see he wanted to just... Yeah, and he was like sitting. I said, just go ahead. He goes, keep coming back. Yeah. You know, and like, I'm like, I just got goosebumps and chills. It was like the adrenaline that we got from the convention and being around like 700, 800, 900 people at that time sitting in the atrium, you know, experiencing the convention, messages of recovery. It was just overwhelming. Like I said, he just celebrated 15 years clean. And I said to him, "You going to the convention?" He goes, "Keep coming back." You know, and it's memories like that. You know, I have a Narcotics Anonymous that, you know, that I savor on times when, you know, I don't want to come to Narcotics Anonymous. I don't want to work a program. I don't want to call a sponsor, my sponsor. I don't want to answer the phone when my sponsees are calling me. You know, I don't want to be a service to the newcomer and pick somebody up and take them to the meeting. You know, and when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, thank God there was people here, like Carla talked about, that welcomed me, that basically when I came in, and I didn't hear, like, sit down, whatever, but I heard it said, I got two ears and one mouth, that I should listen twice as much as I talk. And that people really don't care how much you know to you and how much you care. And I'm thinking, like, that's pretty good. And I like that. And maybe it's easier and softer way, but it was a way for me to hear things. It's like, why would somebody care? I don't even know you. And I'm coming to Narcotics Anonymous, and I'm still in denial that I might have a drug problem, despite the contrary of the fact my house is in bankruptcy, I'm driving a suspended license, you know, $27,000 in debt, and I'm like, you know, 2-year backup sentence with a violation or probation for another 2 years. And I might have a problem with drugs. You know what I mean? And, you know, and I'm one of those guys that basically did the geographical change. Some people say geographical change to avoid prosecution. So for me, it was like I tried to change people. I came here in 1995, and they told me to change people, places, and things. I didn't hear him say, "Mike, you need to still stop using." You know what I mean? So I changed playgrounds, playmates, and playthings, and I found new old people, places, things that were using. And wondered why it was, because I switched up my substances, I switched up where I used, I tried to control how much I used, and I justified the fact that I still got a full-time job, a company truck, I live in a house by myself that I own, my son is taken care of, he has clothes on his back, food on the table, we do things together, but I was not physically, emotionally, or spiritually available to him. And I came to Narcotics Anonymous, and I sat in a meeting in 1995, and they told me that, you know, if you haven't lost your house, your kids, your job, your dignity, your self-respect, your family, your wives, and everything else, you know, keep using and you will. In 1998, I came back, and the same guy that said that, you know, was up there sharing a meeting, I'm like, "Hey, man, you know what? You were right." You know? And I believe at that time that I believe that I was just about, I believe in 1995 I kind of got here prematurely, but 1998 I believe that I was just right for Narcotics Anonymous. And I hate to say it like this, but Narcotics Anonymous was the last house on the block. For me, I looked everywhere else rather than Narcotics Anonymous for a problem that was spiritual in nature. When I got here, I was spiritually bankrupt. I didn't even know what a spirit was. And, you know, and I think to myself, it's just like, you know, the getting and using fires and wings to get more. I was like, I lived the using, used, lived. I was an animal. I didn't need a spirit. I was an animal. I had animalistic behaviors. I had coping mechanisms. I didn't have spiritual principles and life on life's terms to how to deal with things and cope with things. I didn't have a network. I didn't have a belief or a concept of God. So I didn't have a concept of God. So how could I even possibly have a belief? You know, DeJustreday talks about this. DeJustreday, I've had faith in someone who believes in me. And once I got my recovery, I had nobody that believed in me. Everybody that I ever came in contact with that I heard as a direct result of my using believed that every time I came around, there was always going to be a negative consequence of my actions based on the fact whether I was using or not. And it really wasn't so much about towards the end of whether I was using or not. It was about what I was going to do in order to get the use they were more concerned about. When you go over to your mother-in-law's house and they lock the bedroom and put all the purses and the nice coats in there, you might have a problem, you know what I mean? And, you know, and it's funny because, like, there was a cousin that was a husband of a cousin of my fiancé's. He was far worse than me. So as long as he was around, it took eyes off me. And that's kind of like how when I got here in 1995, as long as somebody was worse off than me, I didn't have to take a look at myself. When I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I came in, like, and it's funny because we talked about it one night at dinner, you know, despite popular opinion of me, I am the most outgoing introvert you'll ever meet, if that makes any sense. You know, for me, a strong defense is better than a weak offense. So, I, you know, rather than sit here and stare at you and wonder if Arnold's going to say hi to me, I'll go up to say hi to him for fear that he might not. You know, feelings are things we have the most of, we know least about. You know, they say feelings aren't fact, you know, but nobody's ever died of a feeling, but people have made decisions based upon that feeling that as a direct result they've died. You know, a girl in my home group shared about, she said, you know, just because we think it doesn't make it real, make it real. And when I'm caught up in obsession and compulsion, man, everything gets really distorted. And if I'm under the influence, all bets are off. So I came to Narcotics Anonymous, and you guys talked about the disease of addiction. And you said that drugs were just the most obvious symptom of my disease. And I'm thinking, okay, I got a disease. Like, I remember back in high school I had a disease, but it wasn't the disease of addiction. It was a different disease. And I was really uncomfortable with the fact that you guys were saying that I had a disease, and you know, or talks about a moral deficiency. And I remember guys saying, like, with disease, I don't like that concept. I didn't like anything. I didn't like having to get a sponsor and working steps and going to meetings, pick the phone, calling people. But I really kind of bucked at the fact, like they talk about, you know, attitude or indifference or intolerance to spiritual principles like honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. You know, I had an attitude with that, you know, and they said, well, these things are indispensable, which means that you can't do it without it. So you need to work on it. But you basically, what it talked about, what it said about the disease of addiction, I very simply broke it down to I have a dis-ease. And as a result of my dis-ease, that when I'm caught up in getting, using, finding ways and means to get more, even without active addiction using, when I'm really honestly caught up in whatever it is, which I say for me, it's like the obsession and compulsion, which precedes the using, that basically I'm in denial, substitution, rationalization, justification, distrust of others, guilt, embarrassment, degradation, dereliction, isolation, and our total loss of control are symptoms of our disease. I've been there clean. You know, imagine what it's like to be there under the influence. You know, and I'm thinking about, like, you know, being in a room full of people and being all alone. You know, the depths that I went to, like, we're buying Christmas presents and then having a kid open them up on Christmas morning and thinking he's only 3 or 4 years old. He's not going to remember which ones I take back because I need to go get another one. You know, and then I walked into a meeting and they talked about the therapeutic value from one addict to another, the ultimate weapon, a weapon that can defend and protect me from the disease of addiction. You know, the objective view on a subjective matter. We go on to say, like, we are masters of manipulation and what? Self-deception. That when I came here, I couldn't even see myself coming. You know, and that when I'm basically in denial, which they say the acronym for don't even know I am lying. And I like that. I said, I don't even know I'm lying. My first sponsor said, you're not in denial. You're in refusal. You know what you need to do and you don't want to do it. And I'm like, okay, you're right. You know, and I was somewhere else where the guy said, you know, a lot of us, you know, we love to learn, but we hate to be taught. You know, and he said, he goes on to say, he says, you know, there's two types of addicts. There's cannots and there's will nots. He says, I've been around for 40 years. I've met very few cannots. I've met a shit ton of will nots. Completely give themselves to the simple program. This is a simple program for complicated people. You know, and the program is a program of suggestions. You know, one of the first suggestions was to get a sponsor. Well, how do I do that? Hello, it's an orange pamphlet. Pick it up. If you don't pick it up, imagine that. It won't get in you. I picked it up. I read it. Like, okay, now I'm paralyzed in fear with what it is that I need to do. And I remember, like, and a good thing Carla talked about, I loved it because, like, getting the meeting before the meeting and sticking around after the meeting. Because during the meeting, I'm trying to sit and listen. So before the meeting, after the meeting, I ask stupid questions like, so what's a sponsor? You know what I mean? And somebody will sit there and break it down. Because, I mean, I was afraid, like, you know, like my pride, my ego. You know, my ego says I'm better than you. My pride says I don't need any help. That had to be swallowed, even still today. You know, and I need help, and I don't understand. Like, you know, they could say, you know, get a basic text, but they also told me get a dictionary. How many people in this room got a dictionary to break down what these words mean? There you go. And so I didn't understand. So rather than sit there and say that I didn't know, just like the concept of a belief in a higher power, it was easy for me to sit there and say that I was agnostic or that I didn't believe in God because I had no concept of what one is. So then I basically one day kind of feeling a little vulnerable, and I wanted to ask a question and get somebody's experience, like, what is your understanding of higher power? And then what it was, like Carla said, you know, it was my sponsor, and whatever was working for him was working for him. And since I wanted what he had, I started developing a concept that he believed in that worked for him that started to work for me. Having a belief in something is better than having an attitude or a different sort of tolerance and believing in nothing because I was afraid to raise my hand and say, I don't know. And I don't know how many times I can sit there and tell you that I don't know, and how many times I've said the short version of the serenity prayer, which you guys know what that is, and it's not God grant me the serenity, it's God eff it. And I basically said, you know what, you know, it's easier to go. Like it talks about in the sixth and seventh step, it's, you know, certain kind of distorted comfort with familiar pain. It seems safer to embrace what we know because it's familiar for a fear of letting go for the unknown and doing something different. The guy said, if you want something you never had, you got to become willing to do something you never done. There's a lot of crap that I got that since I came here that I never done that I've done in order to stay clean and still be here. And there's a lot of things that I've done that I shouldn't have done that God only knows why I'm still standing here today. You know, so I mentioned the not-so-spiritual principles, characteristics of the disease of addiction. So let me tell you about spiritual principles and the nature of recovery. By staying clean, we begin to practice spiritual principles. Imagine it's spiritual. Such as hope, surrender, acceptance, honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, faith, tolerance, patience, humility, unconditional love, sharing, and caring. That's a lot, you know. And I try to do some, like, these five daily disciplines. And Carla kind of said, or Chris actually alluded to it in an earlier meeting about certain things that, you know, that I was told to do when I first got here. Don't pick up, pray, go to a meeting. You know, they told me to break down the steps, and that's very simple, basic, when I got here. I was capable of doing that. I was also told to sit and listen, and if I wanted to talk, we could go to double T afterwards, and you can just run your mouth and whatever you want to talk about. We'll answer questions. It was Q&A, you know what I mean? And, like, some of the stuff I was saying, so you mean to tell me I can't go to a bar, you know, if I went to a meeting that day? No. You know, or like the speaker was saying, change people, places, and things. But like I'm in this really toxic relationship, but she's really good in bed. She's one of the old people, places, and things. But I love her. You know, do I need to let her go? He said, I'm not telling you what to do. He says, but anything that'll affect your recovery, that you know, or part of the old way of living is a reservation, and the reservations will get you high. And then after I told him five or six times that it was driving me crazy, he said, look, need to freaking leave her, you know, because that's what I needed. I mean, basically, they say suggestions are free. The only ones we ever paid for were the ones we didn't take. Mm-hmm. So I needed direct commands at times, you know, and I remember going to my sponsor quite a few times. And I said, can I talk to you about something that's got going on? He goes, have we talked about this before? And I said, yeah. And he goes, no. He says, you know, if you're not willing to do anything different, why am I willing to tell you the same thing I told you last time? And that was tough love. And, you know, we'd rather step on our toes and walk on our grave. We are each other's eyes and ears until we tell us something about ourselves that we don't want to hear or change. Then all of a sudden, like, oh, you're judging me, John. You know, but I'm glad I'm on your fourth step. You know what I mean? Like, did you work your own yet? You know, and it's just like, well, yeah, you know. And because what it is, the therapeutic value is that, you know, we see things in others that we can't see in ourselves. And we can relate to that. You know, sometimes we go on other people and tell them what they should do and not tell them that, yeah, I didn't do that and this is the pain that it caused. And I'm trying to share the experience because more than likely, I didn't get clean because I saw the light, I felt the heat. You know, and like I said, I came in 1995 and I had these things. In 1998, I came back and I was losing everything. And I didn't get an instant pay raise. I'm kind of pissed off. You know, I got instant bills and responsibilities. You know, I had to leave my house and I moved in with somebody else and that I was dating, another hostage that I took for my first 18 months clean. And, you know, somebody else lived in my house and I picked, imagine this, the guy was slick. He told me all the right things, moved him in without a security deposit. You know, I was going to the house knocking on the door, and there was a 3-year-old answering, Mommy and Daddy aren't here right now. Like, can you tell them that I stopped by? I'm trying to collect rent for the last 4 months. And, like, you know, 11 months later, I end up kicking them out of my house, and I'm thinking, like, because I couldn't afford to live in my house. And honest to God, I'll tell you the truth, I was afraid to be there by myself. And when I first got clean, I hung out. I got to the meeting before the meeting because an addict alone is in bad company. I'm with the last person I used with, my best friend, me, and the drug. So I would get to the meetings, and after the meeting, I'm like, what are you guys doing afterwards? In 1995, they're like, hey, we're going out bowling. We're going to go eat some meat. You want to come with us? Like, no, I'm too busy. I was out getting high. 1998, I come back, like, what are you doing after the meeting? Like, oh, I'm going to go home. I'm like, I'm wagging my tail. I don't want to go home. There's nothing there. You know, and then I would get home, and I would look at the answer machine sitting on the end table, because we had answer machines. We had cell phones back then. And I would look to see if the little red light was beeping that maybe Sean called me before, you know, like during the meeting, when to hook up tomorrow and go to a meeting, and there was no beeping light. I'm like, I have no friends. And, like, you know, and like, I was dying for friendship. I was dying for, like, human contact. I was dying for things that I didn't even know I ever had, because I had I had relationships, but they were superficial. They weren't, you know, unconditional. They were always about what you can do for me and what I can do for you. And when I couldn't do for you, you're no longer calling me. I come to Narcotics Anonymous. You didn't care about, like, what drugs I use, who my connections were, what I've done in the past. You know, only what I want to do about my problem and how you can help. And, you know, Carla said it too. The only way that I can keep what I have is by giving it away. So what? You're doomed. You suck. You have to give it away or you're going to lose it. You know, the most self-centeredness part of this disease is the fact that you take what you get in Narcotics Anonymous and leave. You know what I'm talking about? You take what you get and you leave. You're just as self-centered as you were when you got here. And you don't even know it. You know, I don't know where that came from. But I'm feeling something over that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, because I think about it, you know, I have a home group too. And, you know, there's certain things that I don't necessarily agree with because, you know, not that I'm old school Narcotics Anonymous, but I believe in certain things. Like when somebody gets up and gets their one day key tag, that we didn't go through the other 9 key tags by saying, aren't you glad you went to another meeting? You know, that because ultimately for me, when I got up and got my 1 day key tag, man, I was paralyzed in fear. I was so shaken. I think I even peed myself when I went up to get my key tag. And I was crying, and afterwards, man, people come up to me and they welcomed me and they held me up. They held me up. My knees were like, you know, I was like this. Yeah, that's what I'm pissed off about. You know what I mean? And that, and the reality is because it means something. You know, man, a day clean is a day one. I wore those key tags like a badge. Of course, I don't know why they give out key tags because I didn't have keys to anything for like my first year. You know what I mean? You know, at least anything that was in my name, I shall say that. You know what I mean? Like I had keys to my girlfriend's house where I was staying. You know, but, you know, she would tell me I had to leave at certain times and come back at certain times. I'm like, this is crazy. I thought this relationship's built on trust. She's like, you told me your story. And I'm like, okay, you're right. You know, I can respect that. Like, you know, I mean, like, you know, like I'm the guy that took my kids' Christmas presents after he opened them and picked and choose which one he did remember. And then I took the ones back that I didn't think that he was going to remember that he opened. You know, and that was 1997, you know, and I got a 35-year-old son. And I got a 9-year-old daughter. So Narcotics Anonymous has given me the ability to do over. You know, what an amazing thing, you know. And when I got here, I couldn't even stay clean. You know, my first year and a half clean, I had to give my checkbook to somebody else to help me balance it because I would get a check and I would pay me. And then I would pay you. And then I would pay me. And then I would pay you. And then I was broke, you know. And so I had no concept of, like, you know, typical things that most people would learn. And the reality was, instead of, again, you know, I got to a point where my house was in foreclosure and I was trying to get it back. It was going back in foreclosure again because it wasn't paying what I was supposed to be paying. Then I went to somebody like my brother and said, can you help me? He said, sure. And, like, then I had to go to him and ask for money to put in the basket. I had to ask him for money on a Friday night to go down to St. Martin's and get a cardboard cheeseburger after to meet with you people. And he wanted to know what I was doing with it. And I said, I need $7.95 for a cheeseburger. You know what I mean? Like, come on. You know what I mean? Like, don't you trust me? Like, you know what I mean? You know, and we didn't have, like, cell phones where I could take a selfie back then and send him that was down Double T or whatnot. But it was, like, that trust and stuff that I had to build. But, you know, when I come to Narcotics Anonymous, you guys gave me keys to a church and let me make coffee. And my own family went, trust me, with $10 of my own money to go get something to eat on a Friday night. You know, but, you know, but for the grace of God, you know that Narcotics Anonymous for me has been a program of second chances and a new way of life that has blessed me beyond well beyond what I deserve. Well beyond what I deserve. If I got what I deserved, you know, I used to think, I should get this. Like my when I went to court, you know, for my violation of probation and the judge was letting me go and my probation officer demanded that I do jail time. I'm like, what, dude? Like, and I went down to the probation office after the thing, and he could see me knocking on the glass, like, you need to come here, I need to talk to you. And the reality was, is like, I was upset. And the reality was, is that, you know, that's his job. Whatever reason why he was doing what it is, and why I put so much attention and focus on what he thought, because I had people like you that believed in me, that helped me in recovery, that my first year clean, I was taking a meeting in Ordinance Road Jail, it just opened up. And I spent more time in that jail than I did in outside meetings with people that were just like me. The only difference was is that they were on this side of the door when I left, and I got to go home. And honest to God, my first year clean, I'd have rather stayed there with them because, like I said, there was nothing in my house except me. And my first year clean was a gift because I wasn't working on shit. Let's be honest. It was a gift. That's what they made me in a gift. It was like, you know what? I did bare minimum. Don't pick up, pray, go to a meeting. You know, and I was more comfortable there, you know, and like, you know, I did H&I for my first probably 12 or 13 years clean religiously. And I did it like, it started out once a month and it ended up being two or three times a month. Then we were taking in meetings on Sundays that were renegade meetings and stuff like that. We were playing volleyball and basketball in the gym with the guys. Like, it was super cool. And they're like, I know you're 5'0". I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm like, 5'0". And I'm like 27, dude. What do you mean 5'0"? And he's like, a cop. And I'm like, really? Like, you know, I mean, like, meanwhile, get this. My first year and a half clean, like I said, I didn't have a license. I was driving a suspended license, taking meetings in the jail. They told me about this work. They told me about this work release trail that came across Ordinance Road that went over to Home Depot parking lot. I would park over there with all the other guys that were on work release that didn't have license and cut up through the work release trail to go in to take a meeting, to bang the thing. Like, you need to work steps and be honest and open mind and willingness. You know, a closed mouth don't get fed. You know, and what I realized during that time, the stuff that I was preaching, man, was stuff that I wasn't living. And it was only way that I was able to identify that I needed to make a change of actions, attitudes, and behaviors, because I put myself in a situation to be around people. And even if it was in a negative way, that I basically realized what it is that I need to work on myself if I want to be here next year. You know, and it was one of those things where it was just like truly a therapeutic value from one addict to another. Me trying to think that I'm helping somebody else is truly helping me in return, because I was forced to take a look at what I was sharing in there, how I wasn't practicing in my own life. You know, the guy said like this, if you can't practice these principles in all your affairs, maybe you need to change your affairs. Mm-hmm. And my entire life I was like, well, maybe I just need to practice what principles. You know, looking for the easier and softer way, you know, what I need to change my affairs. You know, I had a year clean, and I celebrated, and I went with my brother and some friends, and I went to a local bar where I used to hang out with them back when I was using, and I was showing them my medallion. I tell that story constantly, and he pulled it out, and I carry it everywhere I go. He pulled it out and said, man, that looks really cool, and I explained the symbol to him a little differently than what Chris did earlier, but still gets the same point across, and he looked at it, and he shot it right off to the bar in the shot glass. And I'm like, and I'm waiting for it to start fizzing like an Alka-Seltzer, you know what I mean? And I grabbed it, and I went outside, you know, and I think it was a year clean. So at that time, I had a cell phone. It was a work phone, let's be honest. And it was a Nextel. It was about this big. It was like a bunch of walkie-talkie. And I called my sponsor, and I basically said, my same brother did this. Can you believe that shit? He was just like, Mike, he says, your sponsor, brother's not an addict. He says, you know, he doesn't understand what a day clean is a day one. He doesn't understand what it's like to not use. He doesn't understand, like, the, you know, spiritual principles and disease of addiction, that one is too many and a thousand is never enough. It wasn't the tenth one that got me high. It was the first one that got me high. It was the first one that he doesn't understand it. And he goes, well, by the way, what the fuck are you doing there? And I'm like, this isn't about me. This is about what my brother did. You know what I mean? And I mean, a year clean, that's just where my mind was thinking. That's where my mind was thinking. Like, and honestly, I had to take a look at myself. Like, what was I really doing there? I am toying with the disease of addiction. This is 27 years ago. 10 years ago, fentanyl started changing all that shit. Not that it wasn't different before, but the last 10 years, I was toying with the disease. I was playing with my life. I was playing Russian roulette with the disease of addiction. You know, being around people, places, and things, thinking I'm going to do the same thing and get different results. And I'll end with this. And I love this, you know, because this is how it just really exemplifies what the program is about. It basically says, asking God as we understand him help improves our understanding of the steps. When we are prepared, we must try out our newfound way of life. We learn the program will not work. We try to adapt it to our life. We must adapt our life to the program. With that, thanks for letting me share.
I would like to thank Mike and Carla for sharing a great